A few weeks ago, the Washington Post ran an article with the headline, quote, "The teens who hated Abercrombie are the adults shopping there now, and they can't believe it either." It's the kind of article that sometimes pads the style sections of the Times and the Post and the Globe, which is completely pointless, at a point almost offensively frivolous, and endlessly fascinating. The article was not actually that good, I'm sorry to say. I thought it was going to be really good, but it did transport me back to the years that I spent sitting bored in the Burlington Mall while my sister shopped for clothes, caught up in all of the complexities of adolescent identity formation, as my sister asserted her independence by buying clothes my parents didn't like at shops they didn't like, and I asserted my independence by saying she looked ridiculous and also her music was bad. For which I apologize to my sister, but not to Jammin' 94.5, which will never be good. This process of self-differentiation is the bread and butter of adolescent life. It was one of the favorite phrases of a college chaplain I once knew, talking always about self-differentiation. At a certain point in life, we all try to discover or create our own authentic selves, and we do it by separating ourselves from the ideas and the habits and the traditions we've inherited from our parents or our families, and by finding meaning in something else that we've created or discovered for ourselves. These new friends and trends that we follow can do better or worse in how they serve us in healthier or less healthy ways. In other words, rebelling against your parents by taking up religion or chess is probably better than taking up drugs or golf. But in an ideal world, this journey away from parents and family ends up back at home where it began, with this now young adult, secure in their own identity, able to relate to the parents or the family they came from on their own terms, having discovered a way of being that's neither dependent on the parents nor in open rebellion, which is just another kind of dependence. But assuming you make it through intact, through whatever bad teenage decisions there are, this is a completely normal and a healthy psychological process. In fact, I think it's part of what's going on in our gospel reading today, as we see 12-year-old Jesus acting much like a 12-year-old. His parents, observant Jews like him, have brought him up to Jerusalem, as always, for Passover, and he's ditched them. He literally separates himself, differentiates himself from his family of origin, not only his parents, but his relatives and their family friends who have traveled together from their hometown in Nazareth. And he joins himself to another family, a family of choice, the scholars and sages and teachers sitting in the temple, discussing matters of religion. In a sense, this is the kind of teenage rebellion that every religious parent prays for. If he's going to run away, could there be any better thing to do than to go and talk theology with the rabbis in the temple? Score. And it ends in the ideal way as well, with a now obedient Jesus returning home to Nazareth and remaining there with his parents for the next 18 years until we see the rest of his adult ministry. But of course, it must have been completely terrifying at the time. I cannot even begin to imagine what it must have felt like to be traveling home from the big festival in that post-holiday exhaustion and buzz and suddenly discover that your child isn't there, and then to spend 3 days searching the whole city before you find him. They're remarkably polite and patient with him afterwards, aren't they? I don't want to minimize the theological and narrative importance of the story by just reducing it to an example of a modern psychological theme in adolescent psychology. This is a really important story in its own right, not least because it's the only glimpse of Jesus that we get between his infancy and his adulthood. Not only in the Gospel of Luke, but in Matthew, Mark, in John, in any of our canonical Gospels, there is no mention of what happens to Jesus between his infancy, or maybe toddlerhood, and his adulthood, the age of 30, when he emerges back onto the scene. And this is just a glimpse of who Jesus was, of what formed him, of how he came to understand his own life, his own calling, his own identity. Nor is it really a 21st century teen drama, not a moody Jesus running away from his parents to go to the Jerusalem Abercrombie and Fitch, but a calm and balanced young man, astounding the crowds with his precocious maturity and wisdom. And he's sitting right there, after all, in his father's house. His point is exactly that he has not run away from his parents. He's stayed with his parent. But in a way, it is that same process of self-discovery, of realizing who he is as distinct from his earthly parents, Mary and Joseph. Throughout Jesus' infancy in the Gospel of Luke, Mary and Joseph carefully observe all the traditions of their Jewish faith, as Jesus did. They have him circumcised. They bring him to the temple for Mary's rites of purification. They go to the festivals in Jerusalem year after year. Now, at the age of 12, Jesus begins to take this on himself, to come not only to engage in his own practice of their religion, but to understand who he is within that. And the next time we'll see him, yes, it's as a religious preacher and a teacher at the age of 30. But first, he gets a confirmation of that identity. Next week, the first Sunday after the Epiphany, the baptism of Jesus, when he goes out into the wilderness, he's baptized in the River Jordan, and a voice calls from heaven, "You are my son, the beloved. With you I am well pleased." That's the identity in which all Jesus' ministry of teaching and healing is rooted, from his birth to his death, and it runs through that moment when he's 12 years old, sitting in his father's house. He is, above all else, a child of God. He is uniquely the child of God. Last week, I prayed briefly for the repose of the soul of Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who died last Sunday morning. You may know who Desmond Tutu is. If you don't, he was an Anglican bishop in South Africa, first the Bishop of Johannesburg and then the Archbishop of Cape Town. He was a leader in the South African anti-apartheid movement and then later in the Truth and Reconciliation process after the end of apartheid that sought to repair South African society instead of driving people further apart there. More recently, he'd taken stands in support of same-sex marriage and the place of LGBT people in society and in the church that had been controversial, not least among other African bishops. Famously, in 2013, he said bluntly that he'd rather go to hell than a homophobic heaven. Archbishop Tutu's stands against apartheid and against homophobia and heterosexism shared a common theological language. In fact, he called these systems heresy and blasphemy, writing, "Apartheid's most blasphemous aspect is that it can make a child of God doubt that he's a child of God. For that reason alone, it deserves to be condemned as a heresy." Decades later, after apartheid had ended and he had taken up another fight, he wrote in very similar terms of the way the church treats its gay and lesbian and transgender members. "We reject them, treat them as pariahs, push them outside the confines of our church communities, and thereby we negate the consequences of their baptism and ours. We make them doubt that they are children of God, and this must nearly be the ultimate blasphemy." I was thinking, it's ironically and refreshingly rare to hear a church leader argue for social change in an actual theological way, rather than just the generic and vaguely religious language of justice or love. Tutu's argument for this kind of liberation comes directly from these early chapters of Luke. Comes directly from Jesus' identity as the child of God, which is revealed to Mary by the angel Gabriel, which he discovers sitting in the temple, if he didn't already know, which is proclaimed publicly to the crowds by a voice from heaven at his baptism, and which becomes ours in our baptism. And that's Tutu's point. As St. Paul wrote in the letter to the Galatians last week, as we heard again in the letter to the Ephesians this morning, the moment of our baptism, we are adopted as children of God. In fact, in Ephesians it says we're destined for adoption. We become joint heirs with Christ. We become, like Jesus is, children of God. And in fact, in the very incarnation, God has, in a sense, adopted all of humanity, bringing human nature itself into the very inner life of God. That's exactly what Desmond Tutu meant. When we try to exclude one another from the family of God for whatever reason, it's a blasphemy. Not because it's mean or cruel or unjust, but because it's seizing the authority of God to decide who is a member of the family and who is not. It's believing that we are God when we are not. It's claiming the authority to throw someone out of a household of which we are not the heads, but only siblings with one another. And it goes both ways. It's why he was not just a crusader against apartheid, but a leader of the Truth and Reconciliation process. because liberation from apartheid had to be followed by reconciliation. Not because we should accept the evil of an evil system, but because we had to overthrow that system without demonizing its supporters, even its beneficiaries. Not only the black South Africans who had been so cruelly oppressed, after all, were the children of God. Even the most hardened white supporters of apartheid were and are the children of God, members of one family, through their baptisms into Christ. And so are you. So are all of us. It probably goes without saying that not everyone in the world has been accepted and loved and nurtured by their families of origin. But however loving or unloving, however disdainful or affirming our own families may have been, we are all children together in the family of God. We've all been given a seat next to Jesus in the temple by one who will never take it away. We've been adopted as children by one who would rather die for us than leave us behind, who would turn back always and search for us, not for 3 days or for 3 years or for 30 years, but again and again throughout our lives, as we, like Jesus, increase in wisdom and in years and in divine and human favor. So may we have the grace and the courage to remember this new year, 2022, whenever we are rejected or neglected, whenever we want to reject someone else, that we have been adopted into this family of Christ, that we are siblings seated with Jesus in the temple, that we are the children of God, and so are all those whom we see in the world. Amen.